The following interview was conducted on January the 28th, 2006, on Elephant Talk on CHLY in Nanaimo, Canada. We spoke with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former Chief of Staff for Secretary of State Colin Powell. We are now
on the line with Lawrence Wilkerson, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, and he served as Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell from 2002 to 2005. Hello, Lawrence.
How are you? Good to be here.
Yeah, thank you very much for being here. I know you've had a lot of interview requests over the last days and weeks, so thanks a lot for making time to come on the show.
My pleasure.
So perhaps we could start off just looking at your history and how you came to be the Chief of Staff. You knew Colin Powell for a long time, did you not?
A little over 16 years. I joined him in January of 1989 when he interviewed me to... He was just coming out of being National Security Advisor, the final one, to President Reagan in the last year or so of his second term. And he received a fourth star to become a full general in the United States Army, and he needed a speechwriter. And he interviewed me and selected me, and we've sort of been together ever since.
Right, and so Colin Powell's been in the media just recently. He was talking to the BBC on January 17th, and he was discussing mistakes made in the decision to go to war, and he was saying, "We were wrong, the intelligence community was wrong, the British intelligence community was wrong, and all the other intelligence communities were wrong, and I presented wrong information because that was the information we believed to be true at the time." So some pretty strong words that made quite a stir in the press. And how do you feel about him coming out with that now? And what's your opinion?
Well, I think he's been saying that all along. And when I say all along, since Mr. Tenet, the director for Central Intelligence during that time period, had to tell him time and time again that the main ingredients of his presentation on 5 February 2003 at the UN Security Council were indeed false.
So Tenet was telling him that.
Right. And, you know, it doesn't take too many phone calls like that, and you begin to realize that things were quite different. Reality was quite different from the way all these different intelligence communities briefed you. And since I was intimately involved in that intense period in preparing the Secretary of State to present that evidence.
You were the head of the committee that prepared.
Right, right. The task force that put it all together. And
his statement to the UN.
Right. And okay. I've echoed his sentiments. I've said that it probably was the lowest point in my professional life to have been so wrong.
And so you're talking about the UN, the speech to the UN that was basically central to bringing about the Iraq War.
Well, I don't know if I would say it was central. I'm not quite sure just how many people that presentation in the international community and in our own community here in America, just how many people that convinced. I will guarantee you it didn't convince anyone on the UN Security Council. Votes were going to be votes. And we saw that, we did indeed see that happen when we attempted to get a second resolution. The votes were pretty much the way the votes were going to be. We didn't persuade anyone. If I have to look back on it and say that it had an impact, it probably had an impact in both the international community and with the American people, simply uh-huh. because of the man who was delivering it.
Yeah, exactly.
He was probably the most trusted member of the administration, mm-hmm. and probably one of the few Americans constantly achieving poll ratings above 70%.
Why do you say that it was the low point in your professional career?
Because we were so wrong. I'm just like the general when I say it's very difficult to contest the director for Central Intelligence, the deputy director for Central Intelligence, both of whom were present with us during the entire preparation period. It's difficult to contest British intelligence, Jordanian intelligence, French intelligence, German intelligence, Israeli intelligence, when you're not an intelligence expert. So you depend on these people, you depend on these agencies to give you the straight poop, so to speak. And in this case, we not only didn't get the facts, we got falsehoods.
Colonel Wilkerson, my name is James. I'm Julie's co-host. In February of 2001, the CIA gave a report to the White House that said, "We don't have any direct evidence that Iraq has used the period since Desert Fox to reconstitute its weapons of mass destruction." The report was so definitive that Colin Powell said in a subsequent press conference, "Saddam Hussein has not developed any significant capability with respect to weapons of mass destruction." And yet, 2 years later, he completely changed his mind. How could you account for that drastic mind change?
Well, actually, you're cherry-picking, not unlike the way Undersecretary of Defense Douglas Feith and others in our administration from 2001 to 2005 cherry-picked. You can go back and find a number of instances where General and then later Secretary Powell made statements that would indicate that the first Gulf War and the dramatic victory that the coalition forces had won in that war had cut Saddam Hussein's conventional and non-conventional military might down to the point where he was no longer a threat to his neighbors, certainly no longer a threat to us, and he was contained. Mm-hmm. And the only problem was the sanctions regime that was ill-structured and ill-maintained and needed to be smartened up. And indeed, that's the first, if you will, that's the first statement of policy that we made when he became Secretary of State in January 2001. What changed that opinion over the next, I would say probably preeminently the next 13 to 14 months, and in there is also 9/11, which is very important, was the fact that the intelligence community began to shape a different picture of the imminence, if you will, of the threat in Iraq. And when 9/11 came along and suggested the nexus between this kind of global jihadist terrorism and weapons of mass destruction, principally nuclear weapons, it made a lot of people paranoid. Mm-hmm. And I would include in that category the Vice President of the United States. These are people who made a vow to themselves that it would not happen again, and that on their watch, no nuclear weapon would be exploded in a major American metropolis. And that became their focus, and they focused on it like a laser, and they associated Saddam Hussein and Baghdad with that nexus, and that proved to be false also. You have a vice president who still, on occasion, maintains that there was a considerable connection between al-Qaeda and the Mukhabarat that Saddam Hussein maintained his intelligence apparatus. And that's there is no intelligence whatsoever to support that.
Why do you think the vice president still maintains that once in a while?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Do you think he believes it?
It's or a mystery. I can't accept that he would be advancing it if he didn't believe it. So I have to kind of conjure some psychoanalysis. I can't imagine why he's still saying it, but he clearly is.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about the intelligence being wrong, and so, you know, being given the wrong information. And
well, it wasn't entirely wrong. Right. The substantive parts of it about the stockpiles of chemical, biological, and in my mind, most importantly, nuclear weapons were wrong. And indeed, we had a intelligence community, the Intelligence Bureau, INR we call it, in the State Department that said, told the Secretary in a formal report that they did not agree with the rest of the intelligence community, that they thought he did not have, nor did he have the capacity to have, an active nuclear program. So we actually had one maverick element within our intelligence community at the State Department, which was right on at least one-third of the substantive information about active stockpiles.
So you were saying earlier that Tenet has been talking to Powell or had been talking to Powell and saying that the intelligence was wrong. So how could he, as the former head of the CIA, not have known at the time that he was convincing you and talking to you and giving you the information? How could he have not known that it was wrong? Was he relying on his own field workers, so to say? And
he was, I'm sure. And unlike other people, I've been an intelligence user for about 35 years. So unlike other people, I don't have much trouble in understanding this from a point of view of ineptitude and incompetence. I mean, after all, let's face what the CIA has failed at just in the latter part of my lifetime. They failed at predicting the demise of the Soviet Union. they failed in predicting the five-year planning cycle or detecting the five-year planning cycle of Al-Qaeda and its attack on 9/11. They failed in detecting the 1998 attacks on our embassies in Dar es Salaam and Kenya, Nairobi, Kenya. They failed in detecting the attack in Port Aden of USS Cole. They failed in predicting or detecting the Indian nuclear test in 1998. They turned in bad poop that got the Chinese embassy in Belgrade attacked during the Balkans campaign. I mean, I can go on and on at the failures of this very incompetent intelligence community. If you ask me the question, what is at the top of my list with regard to my concerns about the United States and its strategic intelligence, I will tell you immediately. The CIA is broken, and it is utterly incompetent. And the intelligence community in general needs a total overhaul. And the creation of a national intelligence director, as much as I might admire Ambassador Negroponte and wish him well, is just the tip of the iceberg. Much, much more needs to be done to overhaul our intelligence apparatus.
But just because there are problems with the intelligence community, that they don't always know what's happening when they should, it seems a little bit, shall we say, overcautious to assume that they're always wrong. And so in this case, if they're saying that there are no weapons of mass destruction, we'll assume that there are instead. Is that what you think happened? Is that what Dick Cheney was pushing for?
I actually think we had a combination of things. I spent 5-6 nights in the bowels of the agency with the very best satellite photo interpreters that the agency has. And I saw photos that would have convinced me as a military man that Saddam Hussein had special weapons in certain ammunition supply points. So there's the first problem. I think we fell for Saddam Hussein's attempts to send us disinformation. He knew when the satellites were overhead, as does Kim Jong-il in Pyongyang, North Korea, and as does Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in Tehran. They all know now when our satellites are overhead, and they if they're clever enough, they use our satellites to send us disinformation. So that's one thing we fell for that we shouldn't have. Another thing is, just as I've described, our intelligence community is not very good anymore. Mm. A third thing is the groupthink that we all fell into, because we assumed that when the bombing stopped in 1998 under President Clinton, that we could just extrapolate from that period to 2001, 2002, 2003, and assume that Saddam Hussein had grown so much anthrax, produced so much other product from the growth mediums he had when we were in there and looking at him hard. And we just did linear projections and said, this is what he's probably got now. The problem is we had absolutely no one on the ground in Iraq, human intelligence, as we referred to it in the military. We had no one to give us confirmation of these things, and so we were reading the tea leaves, so to speak, and that's not a very good way to get intelligence. Mm. Let me just say also that you're never going to have, you're never going to have perfect intelligence, and you're always going to have to make some risk-filled decisions.
Certainly.
But you ought to be able to do better than we've done, especially when you consider the billions of dollars that we spend of taxpayer money on intelligence.
It seems like there's a lot of contradictions between people blaming the CIA and then the CIA also trying to shift blame off of itself. I'm just wondering what kind of comments you have on, for example, that he wasn't a part of the CIA, but the presidential advisor or the chief advisor on terrorism, Richard Clark, who made an interview on 60 Minutes. And he claimed that in the aftermath of September 11th, Bush ordered him to look for a link between Iraq and the September 11th attacks, despite being told by George Tenet and other officials that there wasn't a link. So I guess what I'm asking for is your opinion on that Iraq was in the sights of the administration even before the whole WMD thing and pretty much after September 11th.
Well, let me answer your specific question first and then your implied question second. First,
okay.
I don't find anything extraordinary in the President of the United States, after some 3,000 Americans have died, turning to Richard Clark, who is the counterterrorism czar, and saying, hey, I don't care if the CIA says there's no connection. I want you to check it out because you're my man, and I want you to check it out. I don't find any problem with that. But to answer your more general question, both in retrospect, because I'm teaching now at two different universities, and what I'm teaching is national security decision making, and I've done a lot of research since I left office, and in terms of looking back over my own notes, and in particular over the year 2004 when I had a chance to kind of stand back and look at this a little bit, I've come to the conclusion that you're absolutely right in your general question. This administration knew it was going to a war with Iraq one way or another, even before it came to office, and 9/11 gave them, shall we say, a hell of an excuse.
So do you think that, according to, as some people think in the Downing Street memo, do you think that the intelligence was fixed around the policy?
I'm not sure about that. I am digging and digging and digging because I'm trying to come up with my own academic answer to this as well as a professional answer. As I said, I'm teaching it. And I'm really growing skeptical now of some of the administration's claims that some people in the administration, particularly the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Douglas Feith, did not cherry-pick the intelligence, did not then shape the intelligence in a way that was, shall we say, very different from reality, and that they didn't do that in an effect to propagandize the American people and make them more supportive of what they were going to do in Iraq. I'm not prepared to make that claim yet, but my suspicions are growing.
Wow. And so what is your opinion of the Downing Street memo?
I have so many different people telling me so many different things. Friends in the UK. I have a number of contacts in Iraq and Afghanistan. I have a number of contacts in the intelligence community here, both that controlled by the Defense Department and that at the agency. And I just don't know. There are just so many conflicting stories. The information that's come out in the book by the former ambassador adds to that. I'm reading about a book a day now. I've read Bamford's book, A Pretext for War. I've read The Assassin's Gate by George Packer. I've read The Next Attack by Benjamin and Simon. I'm reading others. I just don't know yet. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure we'll ever know until historians have had an opportunity dispassionately to dissect and analyze all this. But I just don't have clear-cut answers. As I said, my suspicion's growing that there was more propaganda and cherry-picking and politicization of intelligence here than I originally suspected, but I just can't. I couldn't walk in a courtroom and prove it.
I just want to remind listeners that we're speaking to Lawrence Wilkerson, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who served as Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell from 2002 to 2005.
Colonel Wilkerson, in October of last year in the LA Times, you talk about the little-known cabal during President Bush's first term. You say some of the most important decisions about U.S. national security, including vital decisions about post-war Iraq, were made by a secretive, little-known cabal made up of a small group of people led by Vice President Dick Cheney and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. What sort of a relationship does the Pentagon, or namely Donald Rumsfeld, have at that time with Colin Powell?
One that was very professional, that grew very testy, that grew towards the end of 2004, probably best described as protocol only. That is to say, they talked when they had to talk.
Right.
My profound insights into this alternative decision-making process, as I've termed it, came on the detainee abuse issue in particular, and to a lesser extent, but not much so, on the lack of planning, real planning, and what I call ineptitude and incompetence with regard to the post-invasion situation in Iraq. But there were other security decisions, too, that I think were probably more decided in this alternative process than in the statutory process. And let me just let me just say I'm a student of this. I'm a student of the 1947 National Security Act and all presidencies thereafter, including Harry Truman, as he built the act. And I can tell you that probably most scholars know this clearly, those who are interested in this rather arcane and esoteric process. Every president goes away from the statutory process at one time or another. But what disturbed me about this particular administration was, one, the most powerful vice president in the history of our republic, two, a disregard for the expertise in the bureaucracy, expertise that is sometimes the only expertise you've got, and three, an absolute shutting down of dissent so that discordant opinions, other opinions, alternative approaches couldn't get through to the president. And, of course, I fault the National Security Advisor, Dr. Rice, now Secretary of State, for not disciplining that process, too.
Now, I also have read about what the Office of Special Plans, or the OSP, I've got here an article that says, precisely because of the qualms the administration encountered, it created a rogue intelligence operation, the Office of Special Plans. This was located within the Pentagon. It roamed outside the ordinary interagency process, stamping its approval on stories from Iraqi exiles. When did you first hear mention of the OSP, the Office of Special Plans?
Where's that quote from? I think I've read that. Do you know?
It's from a piece called... It's by Jay... Oh, I don't have it right here.
Not Jay Solomon from the Wall Street Journal, is it?
No. Jay Berkman. I can find it.
That's all right.
Yeah.
I agree with most of what you just said. Clearly, there was an alternative intelligence community set up in Douglas Fife's shop, and what it did was challenge the what you might call the standard, the normal intelligence community consisting of the DIA, CIA, NSA, and so forth, and it challenged them, in my view, by going over information they had already gone over and in some cases discarded or found to not be valid enough to be credible. And they pieced it together to build a scenario that later looked like Iraq presented an imminent threat. And they did that clearly by putting this stuff together in their own way, in their own time, in their own speed.
And they were less reliable than the CIA, their information?
I think it was much less reliable because I think it was picked with preconceived notions of what the situation was. A good intelligence analyst doesn't do that. He challenges the information. These people weren't challenging the information. They were sifting through for data that supported their already preconceived notions. And that's not good intelligence.
Do you see a relation between that type of intelligence and... this is sort of a little bit off topic, but the Group B that was working during the Cold War and sort of also doing the same type of thing, picking out information?
Yes, except I think most of that was for propaganda purposes, disinformation purposes, and one doesn't like to think of people using propaganda and disinformation against the American people. In fact, I think it's against the law. I will point out another aspect of what Fife and crew were doing that is deeply troubling to me, and that is outsourcing a lot of this propaganda and disinformation to private groups like the Rendon Group. When you get signals from the Congress, for example, that you can't set up a strategic intelligence office or what amounts to an information, you say, okay, fine, I won't do it, and then simply outsource it by contract to a private group that does the same thing, that concerns me.
Was the Office of Special Plans, or the OSP, did you in the State Department or the people at the CIA, did you know about this group?
We early, before I became chief of staff, I was on Ambassador Richard Haass policy planning staff in the State Department, about 18 months, from roughly January 2001 to August 2002 when I became chief of staff. So from the policy planning perspective, that's sort of like an in-house think tank in the State Department. from that perspective, we looked across the whole building, all issues, all regions, all topics. And even at that time, I had good contacts with colleagues and friends over on the joint staff in the Pentagon. And even at that time, we were increasingly concerned about what was happening in Fife Shop. And let me add something. I don't think that the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, even knew it was going on to the extent that it was going on and knew the details of it, because it just wasn't his style to go poking around in the subordinate shop's business.
What is your opinion of Douglas Fife? I've heard that Tommy Franks made quite a famous quote about him, that he's the dumbest man on the planet or something.
I wouldn't disagree with the general, but my major concern about Mr. Fife was someone once said he was a card-carrying member of the Likud party. That was my interpretation too. His concern for the interest of Israel was higher than his concern for the interest of America. That was my viewpoint.
And what, again, was his position, just for our listeners?
Well,
what was he in charge of?
He was the Undersecretary for Policy, which is the number three position in the Defense Department. It's the third man in the chain, so to speak.
Wow. You mentioned earlier something I just want to go back to. You talked about information coming out about detainee abuse. What did you find out about that? And what was the information you were...
Well, it started, if you'll recall, I think it was April-May time frame 2004 when the Abu Ghraib photographs began to come out. The secretary walked into my office one afternoon and he said, I want you to get together everything you can. I want you to establish an audit trail. I want you to look at the political and practical implications of what this is going to do to our foreign policy and so forth. And at the same time, he told his lawyer, Will Taft, to look at the legal implications and for us to work together. And so at that point, I began to compile a fairly extensive dossier of both classified documents and open source documents. And by that, I mean articles from the New York Times, from the New Yorker magazine, and other people who are doing really quality research into this detainee abuse business. And so by the time we got to the end of 2004, I had a fairly complete record of what had been said and done in this business, and I had a very profound insight into how all this had come about. And that insight was that it wasn't just individual soldiers and Marines particularly, and maybe some contractors and some CIA people at the bottom, who were aberrations, who were doing this as is done in every war, but a very small percentage, hopefully as small as you can keep it, and you punish those who do participate in it. But in this case, it was much more widespread, and it looked to me like, and as I examined further and further, it looked to me very much like that the accountability for this abuse ought to go right to the top, and in particular, it ought to go to the Vice President and the Secretary of Defense, because they were the ones who, the Vice President giving the Secretary of Defense the cover to issue memos and conflicting guidance to the field that, to a soldier like me, would only result in one thing, and that is detainee abuse. You had two factors operating. You had enormous pressure coming down to produce intelligence. Enormous pressure. At the same time, you had from the highest levels this idea that the gloves were coming off. Oh, by the way, you can do whatever you need to do to get that intelligence. And you even had memos that went out to the field that produced, for example, such confusion that in one period of about 5 weeks at Abu Ghraib in particular, you had three or four different checklists that were posted on the prison walls telling military police, military intelligence officers, and others what they could and couldn't do in terms of interrogation techniques. Now, any military man knows that if you confuse people that way, you're just asking for problems. And let me give you a concrete example of another problem. If you write in a memo that the use of dogs, as long as they're muzzled, is okay, well, the first thing that's going to happen is the sergeant and the private and the lieutenant and the captain, whatever, are going to go in, and they're going to have a muzzled dog. And then when the muzzled dog doesn't work, guess what they're going to do? It doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand that with the pressure to produce intelligence and the obvious loosening of the rules from the top, a lot of initiative is going to be exercised down at the bottom. And that initiative turned out to be and to produce some pretty bad things, including 100-plus deaths in detention, 27 of which have already been confirmed as homicides. Yeah. Cases are ongoing right now. And as many as 500, as I understand it right now, cases in the Army alone that have been prosecuted. Well, just apply your basic crime statistics and say you catch 1 in 10. You've got a very widespread problem. And the only way that could happen in the American Armed Forces, which I was a member for 31 years, is if you've got complicit blessing for this kind of activity from on high. I'm encouraged greatly by the fact that Senator McCain got his amendment through, and that now apparently we've curtailed this with regard to the armed forces, because it was just very contaminative for the armed forces. You just don't want to have this happen in your armed forces.
Yeah, and Janice Karpinski, who is the former head of the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, she has also come out confirming what you're saying, and that she believes the orders came from the top, either from Rumsfeld or Cheney.
Well, just the fact that General Miller a few weeks ago pleaded the equivalent of the Fifth in the military, the military equivalent of the Fifth Amendment, you know, I won't testify on grounds that it might incriminate me, tells me a lot, because Miller was the instrument of bringing the procedures that originally were tested at Guantanamo to Iraq, along with some people who came from Afghanistan, where those procedures were also implemented, to Baghdad. So when a two-star general begins taking the Fifth, that ought to be indicative to the American people and to the international community that this had a lot higher blessing than just a few privates or lieutenants or captains.
Mm-hmm. Colonel Wilkerson, I have the source from when I was talking about the Office of Special Plans. It's from a piece called Informed Dissent by a guy named Jay Bookman, February of 2004.
I think I did see that, yeah.
And he also talks about the INR,
right,
which is, if I'm not mistaken, the State Department's own intelligence agency.
Right, that's the bureau in the State Department, right.
And so there were correct me if I'm wrong, four different intelligence agencies working within the United States, like the CIA, and then there's the DIA.
The Defense Intelligence Agency is the agency that works directly for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of Defense.
Okay. And then there's the Office of Special Plans, which was kind of something of a rogue agency, and then your own agency, or the State Department's agency, the INR.
And then there's the National Security Agency, which essentially deals in electronic and signals intelligence.
So,
and then there's the NRO, the National Reconnaissance Organization, which deals with national technical means, principally satellites overhead in various orbits. So this is a hugely expensive and manpower-intensive intelligence community. And that's why I say to make so many errors and to spend so much money, that bothers me as a taxpayer.
Mm-hmm. I've got a quote from Greg Thielman, Chief of INR,
right,
which
I know
is
Greg.
What's the INR is the Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research.
Right.
He says, everyone in the intelligence community knew that the White House couldn't care less about any information suggesting that there were no weapons of mass destruction or that the UN inspectors were very effective. And then in the article it says that Colin Powell ignored INR analysts' comments in his famous speech, February the 5th, 2003, and almost every piece of evidence that he unveiled turned out later to be false. Can you tell us why he would have not wanted to include any of his own department's intelligence?
Well, unfortunately, in this case, Mr. Thielman's not quite accurate. I wouldn't disagree much with his first comment that there weren't too many people in the White House who were willing to accept counter opinions. There simply weren't. They had their minds made up, and they weren't about to accept any dissent. That's not true, though. The second part of his statement's not true. Carl Ford was then the assistant secretary for that bureau, and I had Carl in my office the very day that the Powell charged me with going out to the agency and heading up the effort. And Carl himself said to me, I don't need to go out there with you because you know how we feel, and you have our views, and the secretary is fully abreast of our views. And I have things to do here, and I don't need to be out there with you. You can contact me anytime. The secretary can contact me anytime. And indeed, the secretary did consult him.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little false that the secretary discounted INR's views. Now, when you are the Secretary of State and you are turning to the Director of Central Intelligence for his views, you are not turning to the head of the CIA, although he wears that hat too. You are turning to the DCI, Director of Central Intelligence, who, under that hat, in our organization, is in charge of the entire intelligence community, including INR.
Okay.
So when Mr. Tenet looks at the secretary and says, I disagree with this one element of the intelligence community, but you have their views, you know their dissent, all the rest of the intelligence community agrees with this opinion here, which is that he does have an active nuclear program. You can make your choice, Mr. Secretary. Well, the secretary decided to side with the bulk of the intelligence community. And it just turned out that the bulk of the intelligence community was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So what changed between...
I just want to mention, actually, that Greg Thielman didn't... I don't have the, in quotes, the second part. That's just
right.
Within the article that the writer of the article wrote. So Greg Thielman didn't say that Powell ignored the analyst.
Good.
Just, we don't want to put words in his mouth
did. I think Greg would say... I think I heard him say that he was really disappointed in Powell for... not paying more attention to INR, and in retrospect, I'm disappointed in myself. We're always disappointed that we didn't pay attention to the truth.
Yeah. So, quickly going back to Richard Clark, the presidential advisor on terrorism, he was saying that after September 11th, him and George Tenet were saying that there was... that Iraq was not a threat and that there was no connection between 9/11 and Iraq. And so what changed between then and, for example, the speech?
There are a couple of things, and they worry me. They worry me greatly. They're two of the things that I'm concentrating on in some of my research to try and get better answers here. We were told that one of the principal al-Qaeda detainees had... essentially turned state's evidence. he had in fact connected al-Qaeda with Saddam Hussein.
Was this Sheikh al-Libi?
Yes, and he'd done it in a very effective way. Now, that was very convincing for the Secretary of State, and I can say that we cut about 26 or 27 single-space pages on terrorism in Iraq down to about 7 pages for his presentation. So that's how much we discarded of what was in there from the beginning when the secretary first started working on it. But we left the heart of that 7 pages that we left was this connection between al-Qaeda and Zarqawi in Baghdad. And now I have discovered that, first, that information was obtained under what I would consider to be torture.
So the information from this man is in custody.
Right, and as I well know, and as most intelligence experts will tell you, when you torture someone, the first information you get is probably going to be wrong. He's just going to tell you something to get you to stop torturing them.
Yeah.
And what happened here was he said something that met their preconceived notions, so they stopped and thought they had the truth. And second, I'm told now that it was done in a foreign country and there was no U.S. supervision, therefore we were taking the foreign country's word for what he actually said. And three, I'm told he recanted. And I'm also told that we knew all of this either before or during Secretary Powell's preparation for the U.N. presentation, but the information was held from the secretary. If I could prove that, I would change my views.
Wow.
But that's what I'm being told by people whose views I respect. And you know, it's difficult to prove those kind of things now.
Yeah.
But I'm hearing enough about it to where it concerns me.
Are you attempting to find out who it is that's responsible for such blatant mistakes?
I'm talking to people every day trying to put this together because, as I said, when I teach, I want my students to get as close to the truth as is possible.
Do you know why people's heads haven't rolled over this whole thing?
Excellent question. Instead of their heads rolling, they get medals of freedom. That is an excellent question to which I have no answer.
Colonel Wilkerson, I just want to remind our listeners that we're speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who from 2002 to 2005 was the Chief of Staff to then Secretary of State Colin Powell. I have, again from Jay Bookman, a quote from him: "Never before had any senior White House official physically intruded into CIA's Langley headquarters to argue with mid-level managers and analysts about unfinished work. But twice, Vice President Dick Cheney and his Chief of Staff, L. Scooter Libby, came to offer their opinions. According to Patrick Lang..." I don't know who that is.
Pat Lang is an old DIA man.
Okay. They looked disapproving, questioned the reports, and left an impression of what you're supposed to do. They would say, you haven't looked at the evidence. The answer would be, those reports from Iraqi exiles, for instance, aren't valid. The analysts would be told, you should look again. Finally, people gave up. You learn not to contradict them. And you actually just said yourself that Cheney is the most powerful vice president in U.S. history. Why do you say that?
Well, for a number of reasons. One, he is dealing with a neophyte in terms of his boss. And when I say neophyte, I mean a person who really doesn't know very much about international relations.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone who would assert differently is, I can't talk to him because the facts are clear. And he's also dealing with someone whose leadership style, and this is no pejorative, it's just a factual description, leadership style is to remain aloof from the details. And when you remain aloof from the details and you combine that aloofness with a lack of any real solid education and knowledge about international relations, national security, and so forth, you're opening up yourself for trouble, particularly if you've got a very powerful man who's the opposite of you and who's willing to be very ruthless and very dedicated about implementing his vision beneath your aloofness. And that's a situation that's, I think, fraught with peril if the headman doesn't realize it's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason I say, I use the phrase secret cabal. Why is he so powerful? He's so powerful not only because of that, but he's also powerful because he's put together a staff, the largest staff in the history of the vice presidency, that is, in essence, an alternative to the statutory staff. Now, the National Security Council is only four people in law. It's the President, Vice President, Secretary of Defense, and the Secretary of State. The President, by executive order or by just saying so, whatever, can add lots of people and normally does. The Director of Central Intelligence, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Secretary of the Treasury, and so forth, all of them will come into meetings. But those are the four statutory members, and they have a staff, and that staff can number anywhere from 100 to 150 or so people. And as David Rothkopf has very eloquently called that staff, it's the committee that runs the world. I think that's a little bit hubristic, a little bit arrogant, but nonetheless, it's a lot of people around the world would probably agree with.
Yeah.
Now, what Cheney did was set up an alternative to that statutory staff. He's got his own staff. He's also a member of the statutory NSC.
Wow.
And now, start thinking about that.
Yeah, yeah.
And let me tell you another interesting...
That's a bit hubristic.
Yeah, the statutory staff usually communicates by email as well as face-to-face meetings and telephone calls. But email has become, as you probably are aware, it's probably true in your area too, it's become a major means of communication. Well, guess what? The vice president's staff can read the statutory staff's emails, but the statutory staff can't read the vice president's staff's emails.
Hmm.
That gives them a little insight, might you say?
Yes, indeed. Fascinating.
So, kind of a big question I have is, if, as you might be beginning to suspect, the intelligence was fixed around the policy, why, in your opinion, was Iraq invaded? If it wasn't about WMDs, this is
I ask my students that question in seminars, and we talk about the factors affecting national security decision-making, and they range the gamut. They range from, at the bottom of the list, perhaps commercial interest, including, of course, oil. And if you put oil in that category of commercial interest, I think that factor leaps closer to the top, to this messianic desire to freedom, even at the point of a bayonet, to genuine paranoia about the nexus between terrorists and leaders of states who have capabilities and resources that the terrorists can't get their hands on otherwise. I mean, I could just rattle off a list of reasons, and most of my students can do that now too, and then we can talk about where the reasons stood in the hierarchy of importance. And that's, you know, that's anybody's guess.
What do you think about one issue that's been brought up, which was that Iraq was thinking of dealing its oil in euros? It's also come up in terms of Iran and the possible invasion.
The Saudis, too. It's come up with regard to Crown Prince Abdullah, now King Abdullah.
Do you think that's a factor?
Yeah, with regard to the Saudis changing their oil denominator to euros rather than dollars. The oil factor for me is a major one. I mean, I'm a realist. As long as Canadians, Americans, Germans, French, and a host of other Westerners, if not all Westerners, as long as our economies depend so much on petroleum products, oil has got to be, in my view, at the top of the list of reasons to be concerned about the Middle East. Was it a reason, and was it the primary reason to invade Iraq? I just don't know. Those are questions that will have to be asked by historians of Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and others' behavior. I can say this, I think. The desire to spread freedom to the Middle East was not a major motivator until the president and other decision makers discovered that weapons of mass destruction weren't there. And so all of a sudden, you transmogrify your mission from being one of imminent threat with weapons of mass destruction to being one of, oh, by the way, I also wanted to spread democracy. Now that has rapidly become the focus and the motivation for spending billions and billions of dollars and suffering casualties and killing lots of Iraqis. So you're talking to a person who's going to say, I hope the hell we get it right, and I hope we do leave some modicum of freedom and some reasonably efficient and reasonably representative government in Iraq when we finally do leave.
Talking about the death toll, the British medical journal, The Lancet, has estimated civilian deaths to be at 100,000 and counting. But also, a lot of people forget that there was a lot of civilian deaths and primarily young people's deaths, because of the sanctions in the years before the war. And I'm just wondering if you were around when these sanctions were being decided on and what your opinion of them were.
Oh, I go all the way back to 1985 when we made the decision to tilt towards Iraq in the Iraq-Iran War, probably the bloodiest war since World War I. I was involved in policy at the U.S. Pacific Command when I was a colonel in 1985, 86, and 87. So, and as an academic, I go back to when Franklin Roosevelt met with King Saud on that ship and said, we will protect Saudi Arabia as long as you give us oil. So this has been a U.S. commitment on behalf of not just the U.S., but on behalf of NATO and the Western world for a long time to guarantee that 20-25% of the world's known oil reserves didn't fall into nefarious hands. And it was a bargain with the devil to a certain extent. And now the Bush administration has asserted, among other things, Dr. Rice most eloquently, that bargain with the devil is null and void. And that the invasion of Iraq is a clear indication that it's null and void. Well, I see a lot of other indications that it isn't. But nonetheless, that's been part of their expressed motivation for doing what they're doing in the Middle East. Again, I come back, though, to the reality of the fact that we're all using oil. And it doesn't seem like they're creating a whole lot more of it these days. And with the Chinese and Indians coming on as major consumers, and some of the projections I've seen as to how much longer the Saudi fields will last, how much longer other reserves will last, and how inadequate the potential reserves are if the Indians and the Chinese come on like gangbusters, it's going to get worse. It's not going to get better.
Mm-hmm. We're just coming to the end of our time here, and I do have a couple of quick questions. Maybe they don't have quick answers, but maybe they could have. How do you feel about the role of the media in the world these days, and especially with regard to what we've been talking about?
Another topic my students deal with a lot. The 24/7 news cycle and the lack of substance in much of the reporting troubles me. I'm a traditionalist, I guess, but I've noticed it troubles my students, too. In fact, I'm finding increasingly amongst the students, and these are pretty quality, high-quality students, a disdain for the media, and even to the point where many of them don't even watch 24-hour news on television anymore. Mm. They've gone back to reading papers and largely staying on the Internet and looking at things on the Internet, even though they know there, too, they're probably not necessarily getting the authentic version. But there is a growing distrust for the media's association, particularly with national security matters, because it seems so facile, so shallow, and essentially conforming to the 9-second soundbite. There's also a huge understanding, I think, in the military now, the American military, and I've got some Canadian friends in the military too. I think they would bear me out on this, that the media can be a strategic instrument instantly. Just reporting on one single soldier's actions in one single location could change your whole policy overnight. This CNN camera, so to speak. I for the past 10 years in government, military and at state, I had a TV immediately in front of my desk, and I watched it all the time.
What do you think is going to happen with Iran?
I'm really worried. We blew it for better part of 4 years. We had no policy, and there again, it was because the vice president wanted no policy. That is to say, our policy was no negotiations whatsoever, which amounts to no policy. And so now we have a leader, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and apparently at least some backing from the council, that presents to us a stark problem, because we didn't do anything to clip that problem in the bud, if you will, beforehand. And so now we're confronted with only one course of action, apparently, and that course of action is to take them to the IAEA and then to the UN and then to sanctions, and then I ask the question, and where from there? Because sanctions won't be very hurtful for them. So where do we go from there? And people look at me and they shrug their shoulders and say, I don't know. So it's a worrisome situation. In many respects, I think it's more worrisome than Iraq or North Korea.
Mm. And finally, we've got 1 minute left. What are your plans for the next while?
I'm going to teach and hope that some of the students whom I teach, most of whom are going into public service, do a better job than I did.
We've been speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who from 2002 to 2005 was the Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell. You've been listening to Elephant Talk with James Booker and Julie Chadwick.